Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Stephen Naish, who is the author of Music and Sound in the Films of Dennis Hopper. Steve, thanks for being here with me today.
Oh, thank you so much, Rebecca. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Could you start us off by talking a little bit about your book, how it came together, why you chose to write about Dennis Hopper and his music and film?
Yeah, so I've been a really sort of big fan of Dennis Hopper's work for, well, definitely getting on 20 years now. I was introduced to him, you know, as just a pop cultural figure in the 1990s, someone who just turned up in movies. And then back in the late 90s, I was in film school and hearing about all these different films from, you know, the 70s and the 80s and the 90s as well. And yeah, when I watched one or two of them, Dennis Hopper would, you know, just kind of pop up. Watched Apocalypse Now, and there's Dennis Hopper towards the end there, just kind of hijacking the movie for about 45 minutes. I was a big fan of Quentin Tarantino when I was younger, and one of my friends on the course told me about the film True Romance, and so Quentin Tarantino didn't direct that, but he wrote it, and so I watched that film, and again there's Dennis Hopper turning up for about 10 or 15 minutes and kind of just hijacking the film again. And yeah, it just continued on like that, really. And then eventually I came on to Easy Rider. I purchased it as a VHS cassette when VHS was kind of dying, so I got it really cheap, and I remember just putting it on, and you know, I think it was like a Sunday morning or something like that. I was a little hungover, and I just, it was like the perfect movie to like just wash over you at that time. You know, I was like in my late teens, early 20s. So, you know, the age when a lot of people first saw Easy Rider for the first time in the movie theaters in the 1960s. And yeah, and then, you know, I just became really intrigued. Not only Dennis Hopper, you know, was in that film as an actor, but he also directed that film. And so it kind of just barrel rolled from there. You know, I just kind of kept checking out Dennis Hopper's work and became more and more sort of interested in not just his acting, but also the directing that he did. And then soon discovered as well that not only was he an actor and a director, but also an artist, a visual artist, and a photographer, and had been around in the 1960s documenting things like the civil rights movement, and also just taking photos of all of his famous friends at the time. And it's a really, you know, so he really had this interesting life. And, you know, of course, he was a survivor of the 1960s as well. And then, yeah, so when I was writing about film, I started, you know, just writing about Dennis Hopper's work, really. And that led me to write a book in 2016, or it was released in 2016. It was called Create or Die. It was published by Amsterdam University Press. I actually started that book in like 2010. So it took me a long time to write that book. But in that book is a chapter that sort of takes in Dennis Hopper's relationship to music. And it did comment on the soundtracks. It certainly commented on Easy Rider and his film Colors as well, because they're pretty prominent soundtracks. But ultimately, that chapter was more about kind of his relationship to pop culture and music of people like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, and later contributing vocals to like a Gorillaz song and things like that. It was just kind of more about that. And then I came across the series Filmmakers and Their Soundtracks, which Routledge publishes. And, you know, it kind of just clicked. I was still writing about Dennis Hopper, even, you know, a few years after the book had been released. And it just kind of intrigued me. It was just another angle to take into Dennis Hopper's work. So, you know, I reached out to the editor and put out a proposal, and I just started writing it in 2021. And so it's, you know, it's been a 3-year journey with this book. And yeah, I just, you know, I just thought soundtracks was a really great way to access more about Dennis Hopper. And I'd also been writing about music as well a little bit before I started writing this book. I'd had a book on music as well. So it kind of combined a number of interests, films and music as well. So yeah, that's kind of how the book came about.
So you look at 5 different films that Dennis Hopper directed. He directed more than 5. Can you talk a little bit before we get into the 5 you looked at as why you chose those 5, why you didn't look at all of them, why you chose the ones you did?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just... So he directed 7 movies in total. The films that I don't really discuss, or I touch on them ever so slightly, is a film called Catch Fire and a film called Chasers. Chasers is from 1994. Catch Fire is from 1990. And, you know, it's just that he didn't really imprint a soundtrack that much onto those films. So it wasn't really an interesting angle to take anyway. They were mostly just kind of scored films. But also there was a realization that those 2 movies didn't really have the sort of the intensity and the fire with which Dennis Hopper directed his films. So Catch Fire was a film that actually he didn't put his name to in the end. He took his name off it because it was edited out of his, it was taken out of his control. And it was a studio film as well. And with Chasers, that was his last film in 1994, his last feature film. And again, it was just kind of a studio picture. It didn't really feature much of kind of Dennis Hopper's, what I like to sort of see in a Dennis Hopper film is that kind of cultural critique. And I didn't really see that in those 2 films. And usually as well with how these films can be accessed is through the music. And the music does a lot of the legwork that, you know, the kind of political and the social commentary is kind of done by the music. And yeah, Catch Fire and Chasers just doesn't really feature the music. So it didn't really have, there were films that didn't really have a lot to say. And there were films that Dennis Hopper kind of didn't have a lot to say about either. So it really, when it came to looking at his filmography, you know, the 5 films that I discuss do feature very prominent soundtracks, and there is a lot to sort of unpack in those films as well.
So let's start. I mean, you start with Easy Rider, right? The movie that sort of, as you say, and many say kind of defines a decade or defines an era. So Easy Rider, because you talk about some of the, like how he engages with songs and music that we often think about when we think about the 60s, but also some more hidden gems, maybe I'll say it that way as well. So can you talk a little bit about that, to Easy Rider and what Dennis Hopper was doing in the music?
Yeah, so Easy Rider is, I mean, one of the first films that featured a compilation soundtrack of songs that were already fairly popular, that were circulating on radio, and that had been around for a few years. And it featured artists like Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, Steppenwolf is kind of... is a very like prominent band within that film. But yeah, it also featured like the Electric Flag and, you know, it's kind of more obscure kind of folk psychedelic music as well. So it wasn't just like pulling hits off the radio. There was a little bit more kind of thought going into it. But yeah, it was one of the first films to kind of do that. I mean, I think it would have happened anyway, because there was already sort of the direction of travel in the 1960s was to start using songs on soundtracks. So you had films like The Graduate, which had a Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack. And they kind of, I think that sort of pointed into the direction that the Easy Rider sort of took. But yeah, like, I mean, it's a very influential movie in terms of its soundtrack. And I think one of the great aspects about it is that it doesn't, you know, Easy Rider doesn't feature a lot of dialogue. And they're also very kind of emotionally cut off characters as well. And there was a lot of improv going on that film. And the music kind of speaks to what's kind of going in the internal minds of the characters. So it kind of presents a kind of where the dialogue and is missing, it kind of puts the intentions of the characters kind of at the forefront of the film. So that's what I kind of think is really interesting. And I kind of feel as well that, you know, it gave subsequent filmmakers that advantage as well, that they could make these connections with their audience through music, as opposed to just having, you know, exposition and dialogue, that music could actually sort of take the place of that a little bit.
Yeah, you're the, in a very short period of time, the second person I've talked to who's talks about Easy Rider and that soundtrack. And so another thing that comes up, and you mentioned too, is that songs were recorded for that soundtrack, and you talk a little bit about that as well. And that was something that was not often done either, popular music being recorded for a soundtrack and thought about in like this holistic way. So I think like Easy Rider is really interesting in multiple ways that he gets at.
Yeah, definitely. There's a track on there on the Easy Rider soundtrack by the it doesn't feature on the record, but it's by a band called the Electric Flag, and it's actually the song that was used on another film called The Trip from 1967, and that they actually did the soundtrack to that entire movie. And you know, just hearing that instrumental song within Easy Rider, you realize that, like, just for that short moment that it's used, is that it would be a much lesser movie without its songs, without its actual kind of lyrical insinuations and things like that. So yeah, I think it really makes that movie just pushes it up just that little bit more into like a real cultural milestone.
So one of the things you talk about is because of Easy Rider, you know, it was like this era, this in Hollywood where things were kind of changing. And because of it, Dennis Hopper was given sort of carte blanche to go and spend a lot of money to make a film. And the next film you talk about, the last movie, sort of was that film. And didn't do well at all for many reasons. So can you talk a little bit about, I think many people know Easy Rider, they might not know the last movie. So can you talk a little bit about what the last movie's about, and then sort of the soundtrack and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a very prophetic title, actually, because it really did end Dennis Hopper's filmmaking career, actually, for quite some time. So yeah, the last movie comes after Easy Rider. It was released in 1971. It was a real sort of epic filming, well, production and post-production period as well. It probably spread out over a year to 18 months. Hopper was given $1 million to do whatever he wanted, basically, by Universal Studios. They gave him whatever he desired, really. And Peter Fonda as well also got that opportunity. He directed a film called The Hired Hand, came out the same year in 1971. And yeah, so Hopper and his entourage, they flew out to Peru. They made this film about a Hollywood production company that sets up in a Peruvian village to film this kind of rudimentary Western film. And Hopper plays a character called Kansas, who is a stunt coordinator on the film. When the production leaves, he stays behind and has a relationship with one of the indigenous women there. and basically stays behind because he wants to open up this region of Peru for more Hollywood film productions to come in. And that's kind of where, like, that's sort of like the core of the story. But then it kind of goes into a very kind of weird and avant-garde kind of styling mostly through its editing and use of sound. There's also these strange little subplots that happen as well. Like there's this idea of them opening a gold mine, which him and his friend go and find, and then they can't find, so they come back, and that storyline is completely abandoned. And then the Peruvian villagers, having seen this Hollywood film production roll through town and seeing people standing on roofs and being shot down and falling and then getting back up again, they kind of feel like there must be some sort of mysticism happening, and that the movies are a gateway into that. So they begin to make camera equipment and sound equipment from, like, you know, sticks and things like that, and it becomes this kind of ritual. And Dennis Hopper's character Kansas is kind of the sacrificial lamb that gets sort of, like, you know, sacrificed to the movie gods. It's a very, very weird film, but ultimately, I think initially, him and Stuart Stern wrote the film together in like 1965, and I think, according to Stuart Stern, it was a very straightforward movie. And what happened was is that when they got on set, they thought they were better at improvisation than they were. And then when it came to editing the film, you know, Dennis Hopper didn't want to make a straightforward movie. He wanted to make a very sort of avant-garde style of film. So a lot of the scenes and things like that were chopped around. You had a kind of non-linear editing style, and then it has this kind of soundtrack as well, which is quite disruptive as a soundtrack. So you have a lot of elements that made Easy Rider kind of interesting, in that you have these kind of folk recordings of people like Kris Kristofferson, and Michelle Phillips is there as well from the Mamas and the Papas, but it's live, it's recorded on set, as opposed to it being like a studio recording of a song. So it's very rough. You have these kind of moments of kind of like microphone hiss and just like elements of the filmmaking practice kind of creep into the film. And so it's kind of it's kind of disruptive to the movie experience in a way. And so you have this kind of like soundtrack which is destabilizing in a way, because it's knocking you out of the narrative, because you're hearing a lot of camera whirls and you're hearing a lot of things that kind of creep into the filmmaking process that are not normally there. You know, people shouting cut and hearing the reels of the film and the microphone hissing. And then you have this kind of buildup as well of like the indigenous music as well, mixed with the kind of Kristofferson-esque like folk music. And it all just kind of builds into this really, I mean, in the end, it becomes all encompassing soundtrack. It really kind of draws you in. I mean, the last movie's got a lot of faults with it, but I stand by it that I think it's a really interesting film for the time that it was made and the studio that made it as well.
Right, and I was going to say it was released for maybe a week or something, and then they pulled it.
It had like a 2-week run on the East and the West Coast, basically, and that was it. And then the film was buried forever, until, you know, I mean, Dennis Hopper would kind of take it out every now and again, show it on like college campuses and things like that, but it didn't get a release until about 3 or 4 years ago. And then its soundtrack was also released as well. So it has had a sort of it has had a kind of a critical appraisal of it more recently, but at the time it was completely panned by the critics, and audiences didn't even get a chance to see it. And that kind of ended Dennis Hopper for the rest of the 70s, really. I mean, he appeared in a few films. He didn't direct anything, But he had maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 movie roles, and they were not in predominantly Hollywood films. They were mostly in independent films, and also not in America either. You know, he would make films abroad as well. He would go to Europe. I think the biggest film that he made during the 70s was probably Apocalypse Now. And, you know, he appears at the end of that film. And I think a lot of people were probably surprised that he was even still alive when they saw that film, because, you know, his kind of, he really did, you know, kind of hit rock bottom. So yeah, the last movie did a lot of damage, but it was, it's interesting that, you know, even Dennis Hopper, he never disowned it or anything like that. It was always a film that he really did stand by. And it really was, you know, obviously his vision to make that film the way that it came out. So yeah, I stand by it. It's a great film. And the soundtrack is something very, very different. You don't hear soundtracks like that very often. Yeah.
So the next two films you kind of talk about engage in really important music in the 1980s, right? And so I wanted to start with Out of the Blue, which after reading your, that I've never seen and now I want to see it. But can you talk a little bit about this? Because it's really interesting. You talk about how, so with this film, you engage with punk and thinking about the punk scene and sort of the punk aesthetic and how that sort of plays into the film and the soundtrack and the music, even though it's not predominant in like musically. So can you talk a little bit about Out of the Blue?
Yeah, I think that's the term there. Punk aesthetic is perfectly suitable for Out of the Blue. So Out of the Blue comes out in 1980. So Hopper has been pretty much out of Hollywood at this point for, you know, nearly a decade. And this isn't even an American film, actually. Out of the Blue is a Canadian production. And he was cast as the father in this film, which originally was just going to be like a Canadian daytime TV movie. It wasn't going to be a cinematic release or anything like that. And then he was on set for a couple of weeks, and the director, the original director, he bailed. He didn't think that anything that they'd shot was any good or usable. So the production was pretty much shut down, but Dennis Hopper convinced the backers that he could take over and he could bring it in under budget. And, you know, he just asked that if he could rewrite the script and recast some of the roles and things like that. But he still had to adhere to some of the practices of like the Canadian sort of arts council needed to happen. So, you know, he worked around that. Yeah. And he rewrote the screenplay and took over the film, shot it in a matter of weeks, edited the film in a matter of weeks. So it was a very quick turnaround. But what was obviously changed is this kind of punk rock element was brought in. The character of CB, who is played by Linda Manns, becomes this kind of, kind of punk rock rebel who has to deal with her family, who are all kind of drug addicts and abusers. And it's a very dark film. The punk element kind of, it's there really in the dialogue and in the aesthetics. And the music of punk, the punk music doesn't really feature too much. There's a couple of songs by a band called The Pointed Sticks, who are from Vancouver. There's a live performance by them. Other than that, there's a couple of Neil Young songs in there. Out of the Blue, My My Hey Hey, Out of the Blue by Neil Young is the kind of theme song to the film. And then there's some Elvis Presley songs in there as well. But really, you know, the film is just so grimy to look at. It has that kind of grungy, kind of dirty look to it, which I think connects it to punk rock even more. And the way that I first saw this film was from a DVD that I purchased from Europe, in which whoever made these discs just basically filmed the film while it was on a projection screen. So when I first watched it, it was in its the most just sort of, you know, it was almost decaying. It was almost falling apart. So really, like, that's my first sort of like memories of that film. And in recent years, it's had a really nice restoration, and it looks really beautiful now. In the last few years, it's been reissued on DVD and Blu-ray, and it plays like in theaters all around North America at the moment as well. A lot of people are really discovering that film. But again, you know, it's such a nihilistic piece of cinema. It's such a nasty piece of cinema that, you know, as a calling card to Hollywood, it was a disaster. I mean, again, it didn't get much of a screening or a release. It did show at the Cannes Film Festival, but it wasn't shown as a Canadian film. It was just shown as a Dennis Hopper film. Like, no, you know, the country would not accept it. So again, it was kind of buried and, shown on TV maybe once or twice in the 80s. But again, no release until into the 2000s.
And so you mentioned
a really interesting movie.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it also, like, the movie, the soundtrack also had some impact and influence on musicians, sort of punk musicians, grunge musicians of that decade. So there was this kind of following with that film that drew the people probably that he was sort of, I don't know if he was like trying to play to them or not, but drew some people into it when it came out. So
yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, like a decade and a half later, Kurt Cobain kills himself and quotes my hey, it's better to burn out than fade away in his suicide note. And it's just kind of like one of those things. It's like this echo of, it's like this cultural echo that kind of has continued into the future there. And yeah, you know, when I, and also as well, you know, the film is shot in Vancouver as well, which is notoriously rainy place. It kind of just reminds me of Seattle in that very rundown kind of neighborhoods, like Aberdeen in the Seattle area. So yeah, it just kind of, it makes that connection somehow. And it was a film that, you know, when people did discover it, you know, people did really love it. It was a film, and people are really enjoying it today and rediscovering that film today. In terms of Dennis Hopper's movies, you know, it is almost his best film in that it's a very straightforward movie. It's not doing anything weird. It's just a straight story. It's a tragic, horrible story, but it's there. Yeah.
So the other sort of film, the next film, Colors, is one that probably, besides Easy Rider, was a film that most people have seen or know about, or, you know, one of the more popular films. And so you talk about his use of hip hop in this. And I think it also, two things that kind of go throughout this book. And when you talk about these films, is his sort of use, they're very white male films, the majority of his films, right? They're geared towards white men, so we don't have women, we don't have people of color in them, and then Colors comes along. And so can you talk a bit about Colors and sort of the soundtrack and how that kind of is it sort of clashes with what the film seems to be about, maybe? I don't know if that's the best way to say it.
Yeah, well, so Colors comes out in 88, and at this point Hopper's back in Hollywood. You know, he's his drugs and alcohol addictions are behind him. He's been into rehab. I think he entered rehab in 85. He comes back to acting in 80. Well, he does actually have some films in 85 as well. He has the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Let's not forget that. And, you know, but in 86, he comes back with performances in Blue Velvet, River's Edge, and Hoosiers. Hoosiers, he actually gets Oscar nominated for Best Supporting Actor, doesn't win, but I mean, just having the nomination after all that he'd been through and after being completely ostracized from Hollywood for, you know, a decade and a half at this point. So he comes back and he's, you know, very, it's a real triumphant return. So Colors is a film that he takes on in 88, stars Sean Penn, Robert Duvall as two cops who patrol the sort of the gang run areas of Los Angeles. And the perspective of that film is totally from the white cop perspective, and, you know, from the white director perspective as well. So that's, you know, it's in some respects, it's not a gang film like we think about, like Do the Right Thing or, you know, any of those kind of movies that came out in the late 80s and early 90s. It's a procedural cop drama, basically. But what's really interesting is that you have this soundtrack of hip hop and rap music, which at that point, 88, wasn't a mainstream genre. It was certainly impacting, but it wasn't, you know, we weren't having best-selling hip hop records at that time. So, but yeah, so what's really interesting about the film is that this hip hop music that appears on the soundtrack, so the soundtrack record that comes out when the film does, has all the hip hop music on it. But in the film, it's this very kind of buried and in the background music that you kind of hear in passing. So, you know, the cops driving through the neighborhoods and it kind of wafts in and out, or, you know, if they're cornering, you know, a bunch of people on the street, you know, the boomboxes will be playing the music at a fairly low volume, but it's always kind of just there in the background. And apart from the song Colors by Ice-T, which is the film's theme song, every other hip hop song is just buried in the mix. And so really, you're not really when you're watching the film, you're not really necessarily aware of it. You know that it's there, but it's kind of just very much part of the gang culture and very much part of their sort of side of things. But it's obviously very important to them as the gang members. Is the music is very important to them. And then, yeah, the soundtrack kind of comes out when the film does, released on, you know, CD and vinyl, and it becomes like a really, like one of the, you know, like a really best-selling sort of soundtrack, and really introduces people to hip-hop music as well, which was, again, like it wasn't impacting the mainstream at this point. So yeah, just a really interesting thing. And there's some really great hip-hop tracks. I mean, I'll confess, you know, I'm a white British male, middle-aged British male. Hip-hop music didn't really mean a lot to me when I was growing up at all. Certainly the music of Easy Rider and the music of Out of the Blue would have made an impact on me. But yeah, so, you know, researching this particular chapter within the book was a real eye-opener for me, actually. It really sort of opened up what hip-hop music meant to people of color in the 1980s and continuing as well. And yeah, just kind of what Hopper did to like bring that music to the mainstream in some respects. And you can kind of see, just by using Dennis Hopper himself, how hip hop became one of the most popular genres of music in the 1990s, you know, because a decade later he appears in a Puff Daddy video, which is like one of the most expensive music videos like at that time, 1998, the song Victory. And yeah, it's one of the most like expensive music videos directed at that point. So in that decade, hip hop has basically overtaken everything. It's such a cool thing.
So the sort of final movie you talk about in here is The Hotspot. The Hotspot has probably a cast of actors who are sort of, besides Easy Rider, I guess the most sort of famous group of actors in it. So can you talk a bit about this final film, The Hotspot, and what is going on with there musically in the film?
Yeah, so The Hotspot comes out in 1990, and yeah, it's probably Dennis Hopper's most kind of like extravagant film, in that, you know, it has Jennifer Connelly, has Don Johnson, like just, yeah, a whole cast of famous people, faces. And it's also, you know, probably it's probably his most expensive film as well. I think it's still only $15 million though, but you know, it's, the money's there on the screen, you know. It's a beautifully shot film. And it's a film that takes place in like this, you know, sweltering Texas town. It looks like it's still you know, it looks like it's set in the 1950s, but actually it is a contemporary movie. And the soundtrack, again, is if you were only to look at this film and have its soundtrack, which is a soundtrack which is actually a rare thing for Dennis Hopper. It was a commissioned piece of music for the film. It's a jazz blues kind of hybrid with John Lee Hooker and Miles Davis kind of leading this, this group of musicians to create this kind of, this like hybrid of lazy blues and jazz music that kind of simmers over the film. But yeah, so if you only had that soundtrack and the film itself, you would think that it was a film set in the 1950s. But actually, there's a few scenes in the film that actually tell you that you're in the contemporary time. There's a club that the characters go to in which kind of contemporary rock music is kind of playing. And so yeah, like interesting that Dennis Hopper for this film decided that he wanted to commission a piece of original music, and as a soundtrack and as a soundtrack album, it's quite a interesting piece of music. As a Dennis Hopper soundtrack, though, it's probably not doing the cultural signifiers that you get in a Dennis Hopper movie. But at this point, Dennis Hopper's not really doing that with his work anyway. He's, you know, this is very much one of, you know, Dennis Hopper's late movies, and the sort of generational wars that he would talk about in his films, or at least insinuate in his films, is instead now kind of like a war of the sexes. It's a male-female kind of interactions that are happening in his movies now. So I mean, it's a fine piece of music, but what's also really interesting is that it took Dennis Hopper's film to kind of bring these two kind of very legendary musicians together. And I don't know, you know, I don't really have too much to say about it as a soundtrack. And in the book, I'm even sort of a little bit, you know, I don't have a great understanding of jazz music, but I appreciate what Hopper was doing, and it works for the Hotspot. But it doesn't really work, you know, in the sort of in the grand kind of arsenal of Dennis Hopper's soundtracks. You know, it's kind of a subdued way to go out, if you know what I mean.
So one of the things throughout, you know, like the legacy of Dennis Hopper, right? So like that's, you know, you have these kind of soundtracks. You talk in the book about how his sort of politics, his sort of social look on the world and on life very much changed from when he kind of started with Easy Rider to where he ended. So can you talk a bit, because you talk about, and something I did not know, but like that he was taking photographs during the civil rights movement, right? He was doing these kind of radical things early on in his career that very much changed, right? He starts being in commercials and so can you talk a little bit about like what you think that legacy is of his, what he kind of does for film, as a director, as maybe an actor, like who, you know, and what does he kind of leave us with?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because it definitely has changed a little bit in the last sort of 10 to 15 years. And his kind of, you know, when I sort of say to somebody that I wrote a book about Dennis Hopper, a lot of the times people are just like, you mean the guy from Speed? You know, they're not really thinking, they don't really have this knowledge that he was somebody who was, you know, kind of very present in the 1960s, very sort of outspoken and pretty radical as a person in the 1960s, and did a lot of radical and progressive work as well. And that he was there with the civil rights movement. You know, he did march with Martin Luther King and took these incredible photos. And yeah, like, but for decades, that stuff wasn't really discussed. I mean, he didn't even discuss it really. It was all very much, you know, he was very much into his acting career and his directing. And then I think what's happened is after his death, and which was in 2010, There has kind of been this reassessment of him. You can certainly go back and appreciate all of his films, but there is also within that wide range of movies that he did, you know, there's some real stinkers as well, right? I mean, there's some real straight to DVD kind of like performances and things like that. But in terms of visual art and in terms of photography, he is solid. Like there's not much bad work to be found, or, you know, and it really speaks to his era for sure. But I really feel that the last 10 to 15 years has been more about redefining Dennis Hopper, not just as a film actor and as a director, but also as a visual artist and predominantly a photographer, and someone who, you know, perfectly surfed between the high and low cultures. You know, he had exhibitions all over the world of his art and photography, and some of the most prestigious art galleries and museums, and alongside some of the most famous artists. But he also, you know, appeared in motorcycle movies and things like that, you know, and did commercials for Ford, you know. and also did like commercials for life insurance and stuff like that. So, you know, he's just so all over the cultural map in terms of where he sits, and it's hard to just pin him down. But yeah, I really, so it's really interesting what's kind of occurred in the last 10 to 15 years, in which, you know, he's being more reassessed as this highbrow kind of artist. But there's room for it all, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say that I think I live in a house where Easy Rider is apparently the greatest movie ever made ever.
You live in my house?
It's like, I'm like, every time I'm like, why Easy Rider? It's like, yeah, let me tell you all the reasons why.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite Dennis Hopper movies is the movie that you probably know, but very many people don't know about, like Flashback from 1990.
Oh, yeah.
With Dennis Hopper and
Kiefer Sutherland,
which, yeah, like, I mean, it's dorky and it's goofy, but I kind of love, because I was like, okay, here's this guy who I, you know, heard about with Easy Rider coming in and, you know, being very anti-establishment kind of. Flashback.
Yeah, kind of flip it. Yeah, he really flips his persona in that film, because he becomes the square from the hippie radical character to become this kind of very much like a Reaganite 80s man. Yeah, I got a lot of time for that film, actually. I've written quite a bit about that film, because there's a really interesting moment where he, as Dennis Hopper, is talking to these two two guys who were probably pretty radical and progressive in the 1960s, but are now kind of, you know, baseball dads. And he actually turns around to them and says, you know, it takes more than going to your video store and renting Easy Rider to be a rebel. And I'm just like, I can't get my head around that scene, because he's Dennis Hopper saying that to these two guys and they don't recognize him. It's like, it's wild. It's a wild film. Yeah, very, very strange.
So this book just came out in February. So I'll ask my final kind of question, if there's anything you're working on now that you want to promote, or anything with the book that you want to promote, like what's, yeah.
Oh, well, you know, yeah, I mean, to support this book, I wrote an article actually for a British website called Dirty Movies, which focuses on a lot of kind of independent and European films. But I wrote an article for them, which kind of actually pulls out two songs from each of the soundtracks that I kind of discuss in the book, and delves into why kind of each one of them is kind of the most important within the soundtracks, and where it connects to the kind of the era in which the film was kind of out. So yeah, that's been published a few weeks ago, and I wrote that in support of the book, so that would be nice to kind of have people go and look at that. But yeah, yeah, just the book, really, you know. And in terms of what I'm working on at the moment, you know, well, I started working on this book in in 2021. It's been like 3 years. So whatever I'm working on right now probably won't see the light of day for another 3 years. So yeah, but no, it's always stuff going on for sure. But you know, as much as I've written about Dennis Hopper, I still carry on writing about him. There's still stuff to discover. Yeah, never stop.
Well, again, thanks so much for talking with me again, Stephen Lee Nash, who is the author of Music and Sound in the Films of Dennis Hopper. Thanks for talking with me for New Books and Popular Culture.
Oh, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Take care.